So here, when it's talking about the four ornaments of the Bodhisattvas, first of all, it's talking about these three trainings, and then retention, the ability to, as Vola had translated at the time, not to forget what one is doing, not to forget what one has understood. This Tibetan word, zungwa, I think also in Sanskrit means dharani. You know the word dharani? Because it was called King Ishvara, Dharani Ishvara. Do you know? Who knows? Dharani. Those of you who are doing the Nyungne are saying the long Dharani of Avalokiteshvara, right? So why it's there? Sometimes Dharani refers to a certain kind of long, or sometimes shorter, set of syllables that supposedly help one retain a particular meaning. Sometimes in the sutra tradition, I think even in the Theravada, there are certain dharanis that in the Abhidharma, the practitioners would call on certain formulas to help them retain certain knowledge. And by the recitation of that, they could kind of remember something, keep something in mind. So the long dharani of Chenrezi, of Avalokiteshvara, sometimes called the long mantra, but the word is not in Tibetan, in the text, it actually says zung, or dharani, the long dharani, is 100, the long one, the longest one, is 100 syllables. I think in the initiation the other day, Rinpoche, Vola had translated that Rinpoche said it was 30-some syllables. What was he referring to? 32 syllables? What was he referring to? Is it the long dharani? Namo ratnatrayaya namaya garasanga. This is about 100 syllables. They call 100 syllables. It means about 100. Maybe om dada 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 is somewhere closer, the shorter, that's still called long dharani. Okay? So this is, here retention dharani doesn't refer to mantras. It's meaning the ability of the mind to retain the practices, I believe. This is from what Vola was saying. The commentary itself doesn't give any more commentary there. Then the eight, these are of these 60 kind of qualities that purify our Buddha nature, our Buddha potential. So we have to purify our Buddha potential, we have to practice basically the three trainings and retention, that's as a basis. Then the eight illuminations, which extremely clarify the door of Dharma. Fuller didn't translate it all of this. I'm not sure exactly how one is to understand this. By perceiving the illumination of the holy Dharma and separating us from the darkness of ignorance, Rinpoche was mentioning that was kind of the meaning of illumination here, that kind of development of some insight in our mind. These eight illuminations come about through mindfulness. You know what mindfulness is? What's another word for mindfulness? That's just memory. Recollection. Mindfulness is the mental factor that acts as the basis of concentration. It means keeping in mind something that you've already encountered, keeping it in mind, being mindful of it. And so without mindfulness, it would be impossible to develop perfect concentration. Another reason why morality, the training in morality, acts as a basis for the training of concentration is that when observing morality, you have to be mindful of various commitments that you've made, various vows that you've taken. You have to be mindful of that. And in so doing, not only are you calming your mind of distractions, but you're developing the capacity of mindfulness to keep in mind, oh, I can't do that, I can't do this. I have to do this at a certain time, I have to do that, I have to do my succession yoga, or I have to take refuge three times a day, three times a day, to remember this. That helps to develop that capacity of mindfulness while practicing morality, and then that is useful when you practice the training of concentration. Here, this is talking, this is retention means not forgetting what you've already understood. This is a little bit different. This is talking about a particular kind of factor of the mind which acts to help to support this illumination, this kind of development of wisdom in the consciousness. So without mindfulness, you can't have concentration. Without concentration, you can't have wisdom. Here, intelligence, the second one, is, what did she call it? Did she call it intelligence? I think she did, didn't she? Lodro, again, when we talk about the intelligent ones. So this is kind of a synonym of wisdom. The third illumination is realization. What does realization mean? Do you know? What's your name? Or maybe you're doing Yungne. Sorry. I don't know if you're doing this. It's Oma. Do you know what realization means?
I think she's going to be nice to me at least a couple more hours because I hadn't marked. I found her test and I didn't realize that I had. I think she's still going to be kind to me a couple more hours until I mark the test. But
okay. So one of the things, when in terms of Lohrig, when we talked about realization, do you remember what the factor there was? For instance, to realize something meant to eliminate wrong ideas about it. Like, there were three kinds of realizing consciousnesses of the seven ways of knowing. Valid direct perceivers, valid inference, and subsequent cognition. Remember? So it's a realization means, it's not just like a general understanding, like a belief or general understanding. It means that you've understood something, eliminating all doubts about it, all discordancies, and you've really gotten to the essence of it, and you see it clearly. That's kind of the meaning of realization. It's a mental activity.
Right, but it wouldn't have to be a prime cognition, but that's
according to the lower schools, it wouldn't have to be prime because it could be subsequent. But in general, it has to be
infallible. It has to get at its object. It has to be incontrovertible. Okay, in your own mind. I'll call those different kind of words. In other words, it has to develop an ascertaining consciousness, something that can develop a remembering consciousness after it also. So, mindfulness, intelligence, realization, dharma, when it talks about the eight illuminations of the bodhisattvas, there was no commentary at this point. Did she say dharma at that point? What did she say? Did she say dharma? So I'm not sure. Dharma has so many different meanings. In terms of some illuminations of the mind, there probably, had we asked Rinpoche, there probably would have been some explanation of why that, what is meant by dharma there. In general, dharma has many different meanings. In the Buddhist tradition, sometimes they say there's at least 13 different meanings of the word dharma. Sometimes it means phenomena, dharma. Sometimes it means practice. You know, that literally it comes from a word, a root, a Sanskrit root that means to hold up, that which holds up. So it means, in a sense, the holy dharma is that which holds us up from suffering. So if this is talking about maybe dharma experience, I don't know, because it's already talking about realization and intelligence. I'm not sure what is meant by dharma there. One of the other illuminations of the bodhisattvas that has to be practiced to purify our potential is where it says consciousness. Again, not clear, because there are good consciousnesses and wrong consciousnesses. I'm not sure exactly what that means. Truth, clairvoyance, and accomplishment. Those were the eight illuminations of the bodhisattvas. Pardon? Yeah, what do you have?
You could say knowledge, but is for consciousness. Shepa, this word that's in the text, can mean to know or to be conscious. But it just by itself doesn't have the implication. She did. I do remember you, she did say at that time, knowledge. But
the actual word is doesn't have a sense like when we talk about knowledge, it sounds like information or something like that. It just means the faculty of knowing or being conscious. So we'd have to check that. The seventh one in the Tibetan text is Ngumba Shepa, which means clairvoyance. What had she said at that time?
Comprehension.
Maybe she was taking it as in a different sense. I don't know. So Rinpoche didn't comment on those so much, but he did comment a little bit on some of the 16 types of great compassion of the Bodhisattvas that came next. So he made a point of counting them or having Vola count them several times. She was doing it in a very scientific way. Did you notice how she was? She has her PhD from one of the Scandinavian countries in, what is it, acarology? Does anyone know that? The study of mites. Yeah, she's a very educated lady. So she was saying 4 and 8 is 12 and 16 is 12 and 16 and 32 is 38 and 12 and 38 is 60. So she was counting out that way. Remember, so sort of like how scientists would count. I don't know how you count. Do you, 4 and 8, right? Not in mites, in acarology, I believe it's called, which is the study of mite. There's a family they're not insects, they're not arachnids like spiders. There's some family of beings which are in between, that she said act as a link between them, and she had gotten into that study when she did her undergraduate work, I think, in Greece and studying in agriculture and things, and obviously more scientific side of things. And then she went on to study that in, I believe, Scandinavia. I can't remember, Denmark or Sweden or someplace. Anyway, you can ask her about you can look on Google tonight, find acarology, or if you have an encyclopedia at home. Or you look under mites, and then you can see how it's spelled, because under the various places, it's acarology. So there's 16 types of great compassion. So you can see, first of all, the four ornaments of the bodhisattvas. That's a way, by practicing those, that purifies our Buddha nature, because it's helping to develop, on the basis of morality, purifying, in a certain gross sense, our afflictions, so they're not manifest. You restrain yourself. Concentration, calming the mind, so the things are not manifest as much. Both of which act as support for wisdom that's going to be able to cut them from the root. And retention, keeping in a sense as whatever commentary Rinpoche may make eventually about that, meaning not losing the memory of those, not forgetting those. So those are going to help to purify our Buddha nature. The 8 illuminations, although I don't understand the meaning so much of, they're all talking about various aspects of wisdom which illuminate the mind, obviously, as it says here, illuminating the holy Dharma and separating us from the darkness of ignorance. So these various things. But the 16 types of great compassion also have to be, not only wisdom has to be practiced, but also the compassion side in order to purify our Buddha nature. Otherwise, you're only purifying, eliminating the obstructions to liberation. So just to hear the Buddha's own teaching and listing of these various kinds of compassion, I thought was very useful for my own mind. And to think, to take as an object of meditation now when I meditate on compassion. So, which has the aspect, this type of compassion of the Bodhisattvas, which has the aspect, that means the way that it's perceiving and recognizing, is aspiring to separate sentient beings from suffering, or to separate from suffering, having observed sentient beings of these various kinds of suffering, from wishing to separate them from these various kinds of suffering. So of various views, so that meant, she said, wrong views. So when people are very opinionated, rather than getting upset about it, You know, are you happy with Arnold Schwarzenegger's views, or George Bush's views? Rather than getting irritated about it, oh my gosh, you can actually use that as an object of compassion because of the various, not only just gross opinions of the world, but people, how having wrong views, the views, for instance, that there is no karma, that there is no such thing as enlightenment, everyone is, that there's no future lives and so forth, how these are incredible impediments to people's happiness in the future, and how they leave imprints in the mind that cause suffering now and in the future. So to use those particular individuals as objects of compassion. These are one of the 16 types here that it's talking about, 16 types of great compassion. Those who have the four errors, what did she call them? Four mistakes. And are you familiar with this? These four erroneous kinds of views? Venerable, are you? I forgot your ordained name, Tesla. Do you know these four erroneous views?
Without. Do you know what they are? So to view things that are actually impermanent and to be oblivious of that, to think that they're actually permanent.
To think that suffering is happening.
That which is the nature of suffering is actually the nature of happiness. Because there is some, like for instance, to think that things that like samsaric happiness is real happiness. Actually, that's the nature of suffering, right? Samsaric happiness. It's no more than a relief. Do you believe that? Samsaric happiness? Do you like samsaric happiness? I know, but that's, yeah. Tenzin, do you like samsaric happiness? Are you fond of that? I mean, we all, to a certain degree, we are. You know. But one of the wrong views is that is real happiness. That's not Dharma happiness. That's not real happiness. The kind of happiness we get from coming into contact with samsaric things, fame or loving words or pleasure of the senses, good food or taste or embrace or whatever, all of it is just transitory. It's actually the nature of suffering. If it were real happiness, the longer we stayed in contact with it, the happier we'd be, right? If you kept that chocolate on your tongue, once you found the right stash, you just keep it there, glue it to your tongue, you'd always be happy. That's not the case. Or always be super glued to your companion, you know. You'd constantly be happy. If that was samsaric happiness that we experience was real happiness. It's really just relief. Coming in contact with contaminated phenomena brings some relief that we call happiness. So the misconception here is that, or the erroneous view, is that that which is of actually the nature of suffering is some kind of real happiness. Obviously, people don't mistake real suffering as happiness. You know, suffering of suffering. They don't. Not many people mistake that for real happiness. Maybe some. So what's the third wrong view? That which is selfless, conceiving it as being a self or having a real self-identity. Right? And then?
That which is impure.
That which is impure. Like what? What's impure? That people conceive of as pure.
Like the body.
This is the classic example the Buddha taught the monastics. One of the greatest impediments to the monastic life or any kind of higher spiritual practice is lust. And lust takes in a certain sense, the sense, and there are many kinds of impurity, things that are impure, like looking at a Mercedes Benz or a new thing, a new coat as pure, but it's actually impure. But the main thing the Buddha talked about was the human body. So to with the scalpel of the mind, to look at that and to see it as that there's nothing really pure there, that the mind is imagining that which is actually impure that we conceive of as pure. So these are called the four erroneous views.
And actually, if you think about it, these are things that we should be ourselves meditating on to overcome, to meditate when we have problems, to meditate that actually what we conceive of as real some happiness that we're missing is actually the nature of suffering. You know, if I had that, even if I had Roberto, would I really be happy? You know, say I'm jealous that Roberto is with someone else. You know, and I say, I wish I had. But think, if I had Roberto, would I really be happy? What do you think, Roberto? Anything? Yeah. Pardon? I know that. I thought so. So no, what I was saying is, if you had Roberto, if someone had you, would they really be happy?
It's proven to be unhappy.
No, I mean, Roberto's a great guy, but you know, one might think, gosh, if I had Roberto, I'd be happy. Nice guy, kind, intelligent, you know, got everything I could possibly have, but it's contaminated. Roberto's contaminated right now, unless he's actually, you know, higher, actually emanation of Buddha. So even if you had Roberto, you wouldn't really be happy. So to have compassion for individuals that have, who are experiencing these four erroneous kinds of thoughts, thinking that things are permanent. If they got that, they'd always be happy, or they would really have something permanently. Or the people grasping at life, having what do they call it? Plastic surgery, in order to kind of almost try to keep eternally young, and not and falling prey to so much sadness when eventually they do, you know, inevitably without any, and now they can't look any younger any longer. And then what do they do then? Incredible sadness arises. So also having great compassion for those who grasp to I and mine. So what does that mean? Is that like some esoteric kind of thing not many people have? Grasping to I and mine? Bonnie, do you know? What is that? Is that like, where does that come? Grasping to I and mind.
Self-cherishing. Mm-hmm. Venerable Soma, what do you think? If you've studied, is this the difference between self-cherishing and self-grasping, right? Mm-hmm. Self-grasping is actually the basic ignorance that keeps us in cyclic existence. Self-cherishing is the attitude that even the arhats can have. So the grasping to I and mind, is that self-cherishing or is it self-grasping?
Self-grasping.
Self-grasping, right?
Isn't it both? Isn't the I self-grasping and the mind self-cherishing?
No, these are two. We'll, in the study of the mind and mental factors, we'll talk a bit about this. When you talk about the basic kind of ignorance that we have, that's the root of all of our problems, it grasps to a self-identity, but also the variance of that, which is grasped at, which one considers mind, such as one's aggregates. In a grosser sense, it can sometimes also include one's possessions, but it's not referring to the actual. If you ask for an example of mine, that which is mine, you might say the cup or the watch or something like that, but they aren't actual examples of this mine. This mine is actually a kind of ego grasping. It's a sense within the mental consciousness of mineness, that which belongs to me, of possession. So that's not called self-cherishing. It's actually one of the two divisions of self-grasping, the grasping to self and mine, to I and mine. So to recognize sometimes, to go through this list and to think of how all beings who have not yet realized emptiness or have not yet eliminated all of the delusions from the mind, to some degree suffer because of grasping to I and mine. How does that cause suffering? What do you think, Daniel? Do you know? How grasping to I and mine. Oh, sorry. He's grasping to his silence. Earl, you're not doing retreat. Right? How does grasping to I or mine and or mine, how does it cause suffering? Why should we have compassion for individuals?
It's just a little aberration.
I think that grasping to something that doesn't exist as existence leads you to attribute, our karma forces us to attribute qualities to that object. So we have to cease to see things as self-existent and manifest as self-existence. We'll see a car and we'll attribute a quality to that car, liking it or not liking it. And then we'll have aversion or ignorance or attraction to that object.
Yeah, I think that's the point, isn't it? That on the basis of grasping to I or mine, all of the other delusions arise in our consciousness. Grasping this sense of I, self, and that which is mine. You might say, well, how about a tree? That's not I or mine. How can that give rise to delusion? So one has to think about it a little bit. But basically, this is talking about the basic kind of ignorance. So having compassion for people that have that. Having people with the five obscurations. So Rinpoche at this point had mentioned, as he was very familiar in the Kala Chakra Tantra, it's talking about, I think the first five I put down there, excitement and regret. Oh no, is that the right? Is that what she?
I looked this up last night when I got home.
Oh, thank you.
And it's regret, lethargy, sleep, excitement, and doubt is what was in my book, not malice. So I don't know, that's what I learned it as.
Okay, do you see a second list there?
Sleep.
Attachment, sloth, sleep, regret, destruction, and doubt?
Yeah.
Okay. So there's two in the... I've taken that... In the actual text, it just says the five obscurations. And in a very large Tibetan dictionary, they call it Singso Chemo, the great Tibetan dictionary, there's this Tibetan phrase that I have after that. So there's two different meanings of the five obscurations. One that Rinpoche was talking about, which accords with what he was saying, Rinpoche was saying from the Kala Chakra. Attachment, sloth, sleep, regret, distraction, and doubt?
No.
The other one. Excitement, regret, malice, lethargy, sleep. Who took down what?
Lethargy, sleep, excitement, mental sinking, and doubt.
Yeah. Well, I know, but then he said,
He said there's four, and he was saying that he didn't quite get the system.
He did.
That's
what he said.
Did you say doubt?
Yeah, she did.
Okay. Usually in the Sutra tradition, there are these, they talk about the five obscurations in various places. So one is this, kind of, they're combinations. Excitement and regret are mentioned together. Then nusam, which means malice, malicious mind, harmful mind. And then lethargy and sleep. And then aspiring for the desirable. Maybe that's missing. Did I leave something out? And no. Actually, I didn't write there. Then at the end of that list should be doubt. So the two, excitement and regret, are counted as one. Malice is counted as one. Lethargy and sleep are counted as one. Aspiring for the desirable is counted as one. And then there should be, before the dash, should be also doubt. In writing that list, I didn't put it. The second list also has doubt in it. Attachment, sloth, sleep, regret, distraction, and doubt. So anyway, these kinds of states of mind obscure a person from practicing, keep them from understanding, and keep them from actually practicing. So for individuals who are undergoing those kinds of obscurations to develop bodhisattva, one of the 16 types of great compassion, to think in particularly for them rather than being annoyed about them. George is so lazy, so distracted, always sleeping.
Okay? Please have compassion. Yeah. Sinking, yeah. I'm not sure if... Did Rinpoche actually mention that? Or did... the translator mention that? Yeah, I'm not sure that... I'm not sure... Because when you're translating on the spot, this is from an actual list, so it may be. Which of the two little lists here, of the two varieties, does it accord with more what she has said? What were the ones she said? So she didn't say attachment, though, right? Okay, so it's probably, doubt does go at the end of the first one, so it's not clear. Maybe they're even in the Kala Chakra, maybe there's even another list. I wasn't able to.
I looked at the Kala Chakra very good yoga last night.
Thank you.
That's what it says in it.
Thank you. Okay, so we'll check. If you want to find more, you can find in the succession Yoga of Kala Chakra mentioning, but that may not... may or may not be exactly what's meant in the sutra presentation here, because that was one of the vows in the Kala Chakra practice. Then, having a great compassion for those who long for the objects of the six entrances, I think she said the six, having attachment for the six senses and their objects, didn't she?
Mm-hmm.
That's not what the text says, it seems. I'm not sure what it means to have an attachment to the senses, but to have attachment, longing for the objects of the six entrances. These are called entrances. Sometimes the entrances are called, certain of the entrances are called the senses. How many entrances are there to consciousness? There's 12 entrances, right? They call ayatana. So some of the senses are the entrances to consciousness. Like, what is an entrance, a doorway to generating eye consciousness? It's the sense base and the objects of the senses. When they come in, when they are present, they can give rise to the sense consciousness. So they're called doorways or entrances. So here, there are two kinds of entrances associated with the eye sense, and the objects of eye. So I think it's talking about the objects of the six entrances. So it's talking about, like, beautiful forms, longing for beautiful forms, pleasant sounds. What's the word for odor? What would you say? Fragrant, beautiful fragrances, delicious tastes, and... What's a good adjective for tactile? You know, ecstatic, feels good. Okay. So, longing for the objects of the senses. Then the seven prides. Those individuals who are undergoing any of the kinds of pride. So they're mentioned in various places in the sutra. When we study mind and mental factors, there's a big explanation, and there's different lists. There are two different traditions of dividing up into seven a little bit. But I just put some names down from one list. You can have just ordinary pride, and you can have something which is... Where am I looking? Which number is this? Oh, here we go. I see. Pride of greatness, excessive pride, pride of I, pride of the manifest, or manifest pride, or pride of modesty, perverted pride. So you can check in various lists. If you have Jeffrey Hopkins' book on meditation on emptiness, there's an explanation there. In Nagarjuna's letter to a friend, it talks about the seven kinds of pride, slightly different list. I think there's generally two different traditions explaining them.
Is the first
pride more like low self-esteem, possibly? No, I don't think so. I think perverted pride means just like really weird. Maybe, yeah. We can check. I mean, you can, if you like, we can go over, if you find a list, we can go over. There, like I say, there are a couple of different traditions about explain. The names are almost the same in the two lists, but then the explanation is a little bit different. Okay? Basically, pride means a mind which is inflated. So, in general, low self-esteem is not pride. There may be some kinds of pride that are, proud about being the lowest of all or something like that, but that's not low self-esteem. Low self-esteem in general is the opposite of, well, not the opposite of pride. It's not like an antidote of pride in that sense, but it's not, generally, low self-esteem is not pride, I think, no?
It's for ego.
It is based on ego, but it's said to be like a balloon, inflated. For instance, being proud, thinking, yeah, I come from a good family. I'm an American. I'm a Texan. My father was... having different kinds of thoughts, inflating one's sense of identity, either because of education, class, wealth, attractiveness, whatever, caste, those are the usual kind, the general meaning of pride. It means an inflated mind, something like a balloon which is expanded. And that kind of state of mind obviously becomes one of the greatest obstacles to making realizations, even in the spiritual path. And there's a famous Tibetan adage, in the springtime, the grass first grows in the low valley. And as the summer progresses, it grows along the sides of the hills, which are up a little higher, a little cooler. But the grass never grows on the snowy, rocky mountains. So one of the implications of that is that realizations grow first in the humble mind, as one sees oneself receptive. You see the way Lama Sopa Rinpoche comports himself with his gurus and, our other gurus comport themselves when they're with His Holiness, very humbly, always in a sense being receptive, listening, not putting yourself in a position of criticizing or, he made a grammatical mistake, I've heard this before, I've heard better explanations of this before, something. With that kind of state of mind, it's like being up on the snowy mountains, whatever kind of blessings or information is being imparted, one is not a receptacle to sort of have that fall or descend. So it's one of the great obstacles. Lama Yeshe once, my teacher Lama Yeshe once said, what is the best antidote of pride? Pardon? You're only familiar with this means. If someone says, what's the antidote of anger? You can say, patience. But what does that mean? How do you just say, sure, I'll just be patient. You're angry. You'll have a lot of pride. I'll just be humble. What does that mean? Lama said one of the best ways to develop, you say, humility or antidote to pride was loving kindness. He said, just like this, he says, how could you, in explaining something to your mother, who you have great love for, how could you possibly, feel that you knew more than her? Mother, you don't understand Microsoft Word, excuse me. These matrix equations, or mites or whatever, you don't understand her. Or, the 16 great compassions, you couldn't comprehend this. There'd be no way, if you really loved someone, that you could develop an inflated mind. So that's one of the great antidotes to that. So to feel great compassion and to meditate on those that have these various kinds of pride. I'm sorry, Bonnie, yeah?
Those longings for the objects of the six entrances, five senses, and then it's the six longing to take on heat aggregates or...
No, I think the six entrances, then there's the mind itself, the objects of mind. So, like, objects of sight means longing for beautiful objects and sounds and smells and tastes and tactile objects, and then objects of mind, you know, things that are beautiful, you know, that which is, you know, the intellectual pleasure that people long for, that they often, people who are call themselves intellectuals, consider to be real happiness, not base happiness of beer and potatoes or football, but the great intellectual pleasures of Mozart, you know, the great paintings, Rembrandt. We consider the, you know, some people, those, in a sense, the pleasure is not so much, there's more intellectual pleasure there, isn't there? I mean, there may be a certain pleasure in the sound, but they're actually attached to the intellectual objects, the fascination with chess or strategy or things like this, intellectual things. I gave a course in some years ago. I had a friend in Switzerland whose husband was a very wealthy art collector, and had not just collector, had galleries in Zurich and Bern. And at one of the meditation courses, when I talked about all of the things that we encounter in the world are actually the nature of suffering. And afterwards, she tried to correct me very kindly. She said, "Oh no, George, you know, you don't understand. Actually, there's some things that are real pleasure. You know, the paintings that we collect, these are real objects of pleasure." You know, and I thought, well, you know, if they are real objects of pleasure, if you just looked at those all the time, you would be constantly, you know, increasingly blissful. But that's not the case. You could show them to your dog or cat, and they might just think of it as a place to, you know, to go to the toilet or something. It's not necessarily to them. It's not, if it were naturally beautiful, naturally, you know, something higher. So we often are long for these various kinds of things. So we long for intellectual kinds of stimulation too. That's one of the big hindrances when you do retreat, isn't it? One of the major obstacles to doing a retreat is to, the two things that you, there's certain things you should try to collect, certain collections to overcome defects in the mind. And two of them are contentment and, what do we say, contentment and, what's the other word? Satisfaction. So as Thupten Pemo has great contentment and satisfaction, sometimes needs a bit, when she comes out of it, she sometimes needs quite a bit, but she's getting there. And I'm hopefully, I don't have as much contentment or satisfaction. Some of the meditators say that that's one of the big hindrances. If you're trying to do a Shine retreat, say, you're trying to meditate on single point of concentration, in between sessions thinking, oh, I need to have a book to read. I need to write some letters, or it should, you know, it's not being totally content with what one's had. So seeking sometimes intellectual stimulation, that can be a big hindrance also. So longing for the objects of the six entrances or the six senses can mean, the sixth one can mean the mental objects. Yeah.
People are very prideful, men are very prideful about being humble.
It's really?
Oh yeah. It's a badge of, you strive towards it, and people admire you for being humble.
Mm-hmm. So there's a cloud of pride and humility. Yeah?
And there's two things that go together. They admire you for being ugly. If you can carry your ugliness well, it's a matter of pride.
I've got that though. Yeah.
And then thirdly, thirdly, if you're formal.
If you're what? Formal.
Formal.
As opposed to casual.
Formal, feo, humilde. If you have those three qualities, it's like you're developing into a good person and a strong person and a successful person.
That can have a good side to it.
So that's why I was interested in hearing about your list of seven prides.
There can be some good, there can be some good qualities involved there. Obviously, I always thought the Mexicans were more macho than into.
Well, that's kind of
humility.
Like
Taco
Bell. That's kind of like a misnomer. It's, you know, it's like calling a gay some awful name.
Yeah.
You know, it's really like real Mexicans that strive towards that. And they usually do very well. They're usually successful.
Yeah.
And they can afford to be those things.
So we can, actually, we can be proud of, maybe that's what Venerable Angie was talking about too, when we're talking about low self-esteem. We can be proud of certain things like that. Like, for instance, the German fencers, the sword fighters in the past were often proud of their scars, even though they might be disfiguring to a certain extent, because there was a certain nobility engendered, I guess, by that in the minds of others. So one could be, there are various kinds of pride one can have like that. Anyway, people that, these are all objects of our great compassion. Those who have degenerated from the Arya path, so this is one of the ones that Rinpoche had to explain. He said this had some interesting sidelights. Does anyone remember what that means? Can you degenerate from the Arya path, actually? What do you think, Frank?
Yeah, but you can fall just before becoming an Arya.
So how can you do that? How can that happen? Well, one of the things that comes up here is when one of the incredible defects of anger is that, even for bodhisattvas, anger can arise, especially just before the Arya path. It's possible, maybe not just in the meditative session before, but because when certain kind of anger is completely eliminated from the mind when one realizes emptiness directly. But on that path that's leading up to the Arya path, generating anger, especially toward a bodhisattva or even an ordinary being, can put off, if not close off certain realizations, sort of eliminate the merit that was supporting one's realization that was about to take place, it can put it off for a long period. So that's what Rinpoche said this was meaning, that it was referring to that kind of phenomena, falling or degenerating from the Arya path in a sense of developing either anger or wrong views that, what's a word? Postpone. Good. Postpone the realizations. Or might, you know, cause them to be, that you have to accumulate that merit from scratch again because you've just eliminated it all. So when you think about the same thing, you can think, whoa, I'm like that also. Wow. You know, if you can feel some kind of sympathy for yourself, which is unfounded and incorrect, because you have to use yourself sometimes as an example to feel compassion for others. And sometimes feeling compassion for others helps you to understand your own situation and develop some renunciation too, to think, wow, what am I doing? I'm just, by getting angry, by holding wrong views, by being so obstinate and criticizing holy beings or whatever, I'm actually creating obstacles to my own eventual realization, in a sense like postponing the Arya path, degenerating from that. And then one can see it in others, perhaps. Those who lack independence, having compassion for those. Did Rinpoche mention anything there? Was there some comment in commentary to that? I was just translating here. Yeah, self-determination or independence. We say rong wong. So you could say independence or self-control. It doesn't mean self-control in the sense of like the people are just going crazy. Oh, wow. Come on, get a hold of yourself. It's not meaning that kind of have self-control, but who lack, doesn't, I don't believe it means that either. It means those who are under the influence of others, who don't have control of their own destiny. We all have all beings, we're all under the influence of karma and delusion, so we're not completely independent. But here, like say animals, if you look at a horse or a donkey in India, oh, the poor thing, you know, that pull the carts in the streets, or the animals that people use in the food industry here. They have no... Some cows are put in little metal kind of, what do you call them, stalls. Sometimes there's certain kinds of cows, they don't move their whole life. They can only squat down in their own excrement and then stand up again. So no control whatsoever, let alone those who have no control to be able to practice the Dharma because they're under the influence of others because of exterior reasons, because their own karma, basically. But I believe that's one of the things that's being mentioned here. It's not talking about those who lack self-control or something like that. Having compassion for those who are angry and create sinful actions, or this sinful is a difficult word. We say dikbe le. How do you translate that, Pema? Dikba? Lama Zogu Rinpoche says negativity, or what do they say in Sanskrit? Papa? Papam. So sin sounds like something very Christian or Catholic, doesn't it, in the West? But I think maybe there are some other, we have to find some words, because it doesn't just mean negative actions. It's actually talking about actions. No, but there is another word for non-virtuous, migewa. Here it says dikbe le. So you could say negative actions or sinful. Sinful, I just put down. It's the object of conversation. So for individuals who are angry and engage in negative actions, to have compassion for them rather than yourself to feel resentful or angry toward them. Like the people in Iraq now, who are retaliating with anger, I presume, against the United States soldiers and blowing up bombs and things. Not that the forces that have gone in there are completely right, but that's an example of having compassion for those individuals because they're creating negative karma and their anger is creating the continuity of anger in the future in their mind stream. Having compassion for those without Arya wisdom. Arya wisdom means the wisdom that realizes emptiness. Having compassion for those who have not realized subtle dependent arising. Do you remember what subtle dependent... Yes, Peter Mo? Yes?
Oh, 4 minutes.
Oh, 4 minutes. I thought you were... does anyone remember what subtle dependent arising meant? Chris, were you here in that talk? Subtle dependent arising. When we talk about emptiness, there's kind of some word. There is a way of understanding how phenomena do appear, that we say they are dependent arisings. Any phenomena, even emptiness, is a dependent arising. It arises not because of causes and conditions. There's different subtleties of dependent arising. So here it's having compassion for those who've not realized the subtle meaning of dependent arising. That is how all phenomena are merely imputed by the mind, I guess. So it's a synonym, it's an understanding that helps support the realization of emptiness. Having compassion for those who haven't abandoned the imprints of essentially wrong views. So they still have imprints in their mind that prevent them, even though they may not be holding those wrong views manifestly, the imprints in them act as obstacles to making the correct views. Compassion for those who are not free from the burden of suffering. We all have, even different kinds of suffering, which becomes a burden, something we have to bear. Having compassion for those who are deceitful and of proud conduct. Those who have degenerated from aspire, and these two, as Rinpoche said, had to be divided up, otherwise you didn't get 16. Degenerated from, he said, aspiring for high status, no longer, sort of practicing in order to find higher rebirths in the future, and those who have degenerated from the path leading to liberation. That was the question that Mama Zopa Rinpoche asked at the end. How could you degenerate from liberation? Because once you've attained liberation or nirvana, you've completely ceased in your mind the causes of suffering. There's no way that you can degenerate from that. So that's just a little... I thought that was, for my own mind, that was one of the things that was the gems that Rinpoche actually went to the the great effort of explaining those 16, which is not found in a lot of the other translations, and maybe there was a reason for that that gave us some grist for the mill of our meditation on compassion. So what do you think? You okay? You have one question?
If I could find it was something, the antidote, it was talking about an antidote, and bodhicitta is antidote to blank, to see infinite. I have a blank here because I didn't get that word. Bodhicitta is the antidote to something, to see infinite.
Does anyone...
It was right after the three things that Karen was talking about. The bodhicitta.
I don't know. I can't fill in your blank. One thing I just mentioned before we finish, and then we'll dedicate the merits. And if anyone wants to stay around, I'm happy to stay around a little bit longer to talk about this. But Rinpoche gave the example of the two sides of Buddha potential. When we talk about the potency of the omniscient mind has to have a counterpoise of the receptivity of our minds. Remember the example of the axe and the tree? And our minds, in a sense, the Buddha nature of our minds, the Buddha potential, like the tree that is susceptible to the enlightened activity of the Buddhas. There are various kinds of ways that the Buddha acts. Rinpoche did make a couple of points too. He said that the primary activity is, or the supreme activity, is the turning of the wheel of Dharma. You know, this is the way that you can lead sentient beings and benefit them most directly. So that's an action of what? Body, speech, or mind? It's an action of speech. So that's why certainly in Tantra, and in a certain sense in the Sutra tradition, we always put the text highest. If you go under the gompas, the texts are always kept highest above the statues. You'd never put a text and then put a statue on top of it, because the Buddhist speech is considered to be most supreme, the activity of the Buddhist speech. And also there are activities, enlightened activities of the Buddha's body in showing various things, showing miraculous deeds or acting in certain ways in which we learn and affects our mind. And also the Buddha's mind itself can enter into our mind and cause our mind to ripen, like the blessings of our mind through, you know, the not only meditating but being due to the speech of the Buddha, but also being blessed by the Buddha's continuum. So there's different kinds of the acts-like activities of the Buddha manifest in body, speech, and mind. But Rinpoche said predominantly the speech is the most important. So what do we just call it a day, a night there, and let's dedicate the merits. So as we've done before, try to imagine the conventional dedication, which is aspiring that these merits that we've created tonight, that we've created in the past also, because you don't have to dedicate only these merits, merits that have not yet ripened, virtuous karma, that will ripen within cyclic existence unless they're affected, unless they're degenerated or caused to disintegrate due to anger or wrong view. They definitely have some potency to bring some relief within cyclic existence. Due to this merit, may it not ripen simply in my happiness within cyclic existence, but may they always become a cause of my continued spiritual development, not for a short time, all the way until enlightenment. Due to these merits, may I progress the entire path. That has to be progressed in some kind of graduated way, all the way until enlightenment, due to these merits, so that from that stance I'll be able to benefit all sentient beings, spontaneously, like the Buddha's, without thinking what needs to be done, but spontaneously doing it and acting the welfare of sentient beings, knowing exactly the inclination, the needs, and so forth. And then try to seal that dedication, the conventional dedication, within the emptiness of the three spheres once you've gotten a sense of that dedication. The emptiness of the merit that's being dedicated, the goal that's being dedicated to, our gradual awakening and full enlightenment for the welfare of others, and the act of dedication, this mental activity that we're undergoing now, trying to aspire that these karmic seeds ripen in that particular way. All of them labeled by the mind, but can't be found the way that the mind perceives them, as though they existed inherently from their own side. No merits, no goal, no dedication, ultimately. Yet still functioning because they're dependent arisings.